At first, I was nervous about putting comedy in a review show, but Bob said that Zombie Takeout, one of the greatest podcasts ever recorded, did exactly that. Mixed genres. Hello, and welcome to episode 471 of Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
Hello, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, I think I figured out exactly why we disagreed so dramatically much last week, because it's been a while since we've split that much on a movie. Have you ever heard of a genre called slice of life?
Sure.
What do you think about it?
It can be interesting.
See, I'm a big fan. It's a big thing in anime. I love slice of life. And that's what a lot of that movie was. And, you know, from what I know about Forrest Gump, that was a lot of slice of life. Nothing really happens.
Well, the thing with Forrest Gump is that it was kind of an absurd slice of life.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, he just happened to find himself situations. Which is why I drew the comparison. Mm-hmm. I think you mistook his bad writing for an artistic statement.
Perhaps. I added a couple of movies to the list to kind of test my theory. I looked up slice of life movies, because I wasn't sure if that was a thing. It's more common.
We've done some slice of life movies, actually. I remember calling them out and we're like, oh, you know.
Because the one episode that never aired because we disagreed too much to have a decent conversation about it was kind of a slice of life film. But I added Lucky, Harry Dean Stanton's last film.
Oh.
Which we would have gotten to eventually anyway.
Okay.
And American Graffiti, which I feel like we kind of have to review.
You think so?
I mean, it's Lucas's. You know, we did THX. This is his other, you know, early film.
We've done Howard the Duck.
Mm-hmm. So I figure American Graffiti's kind of in our, you know, was not really in our wheelhouse, but it was inevitable for us.
And we haven't done the prequels though.
And Stanton, we got to do Stanton's last film. All right, so on to this week's movie, which kicks off our Nicolas Cage trilogy. Yes, we're doing a Nicolas Cage trilogy.
Ah, you know, if only we knew about the Razzies and their category of Bruce Willis, best Bruce, worst Bruce Willis film. We could have done a Bruce Willis.
Well, he already did Cop Out, and you know.
True. But no, he did like 9 bad movies.
I know.
Just over the last year alone.
But that's the thing, because we've talked about Cage's, you know, one great movie a decade or performance a decade.
And honestly, after the last 2 weeks, I needed this.
And, you know, we didn't even pick those movies necessarily. This is one of those movies.
Yeah.
The third one, definitely not one of those movies. And the middle one, we'll see. It looks promising.
We have no idea. It looks very weird. The trailer that you'd sent me also looks interesting.
Oh, yes. We will talk about one of those. Speaking of Cage, before we announce this week's movie, his upcoming movie this year, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. With Pedro Pascal of The Mandalorian.
Of course.
Cage plays himself. Neil Patrick Harris kind of gets him into this gig where all he has to do is show at a rich person's party. And
I'm trying to remember the comedian that kind of did the same thing. I think it was like Russell Brand, you know, talked about like talked about being in that kind of situation where like, you know, oh no, not Russell Brand, the other Russell, now I can't remember his name.
But this celebrity, this rich guy who and Cage kind of form a bond, they become really close friends, and then Cage finds out that the guy basically runs a drug cartel. And, you know, gets hired by the feds to take him down. It looks like it'll be very interesting. But on to this week's movie, which is absolutely one of Cage's best performances, possibly his best performance that I've seen, at least. And it is from 2002 Adaptation. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Writer's Block. There should probably be a joke here, but I couldn't think of anything good.
And also brought to you by the Gator Ex Machina. You don't even have to earn it if you're in Florida. All right, so we have a very budding, talented screenwriter who is on the set of one of my favorite movies, being John Malkovich.
Well, he wasn't a budding screenwriter at that point. He was pretty well established, wasn't he? Or was that early in his career?
I thought that was pretty early.
Okay, maybe it was.
Like, that was kind of the breakthrough, I thought.
All right. I thought he'd been working for a while. But anyway, either way.
I think he'd done some, like, other, you know, maybe small things before that. But that either was way. Like...
Charlie Kaufman, you know, on yes. the set of...
right.
Yeah, Malkovich. And so
my guess is they CGI'd Cage into, like, some back scene stuff that they were building. And, he's actually working on his next thing. He'd gotten a deal to do a very real book about flowers by a very real writer from The New Yorker. And he has to somehow turn this book about an orchid thief who just, you know,
his motive... incidentally, the title of the book.
His only motive was really to preserve the species of orchid because he was a real, you know, thing for it. And he found a loophole that if he had some Native Americans with him, they could steal it for him as long as he didn't touch it. Everything was fine. And so how do you make that into a story, of course, which is the Kaufman struggle of finding a movie in this. And he is hitting his head on the wall for pretty much a good, the first 45 minutes of this, I would say, just going in all of these different crazy directions as to how to do it. But it's all very esoteric, and it is almost like Plato's Symposium, really, in the first half hour, 45 minutes.
I feel like this is Charlie's nod to Andy, if you get my meaning.
Maybe.
It's maybe got a bit of an Andy Kaufman feel to it in a lot of ways.
So he starts hitting rock bottom when his brother, who's, you know, kind of a simple guy, but...
his twin brother, of course, also played by Nicolas Cage.
Yes. His twin brother, who had been kind of working on becoming a screenwriter himself, and, you know, he comes up with some terrible thriller movie where, you know, it's multiple personalities and everybody's the same guy. And
the victim, the cop, and the killer are all the same person.
The victim, the cop, and the killer are all one and the same. And of course, Charlie's trying to explain, well, how would this actually happen in the real world?
And I think Kaufman was kind of taking a shot at himself in that. Because he's known for these weird left of center twisted ideas.
Well, it is funny that he's had that scene in particular is funny because he's having an argument with his imaginary or fake twin brother about multiple personalities. Yeah. But so there's a lot of that in this. Mm-hmm. But
it's a Charlie Kaufman Spike Jonze movie.
Right. He finally gives in to his brother because his brother gets this huge, like, you know, six-figure deal kind of thing for his shitty script, and he'd been talking about going to this this, you know, writing workshop, and he finally gives in and just goes, what do I have to lose, because he's at rock bottom, and takes him on as a mentor. Well, he you know, gets yelled at by the guy who, I mean, what a scene that is. And pretty much sets him straight, and he decides he's going to ask his brother to help him start writing. And of course, they don't make direct mention of this, but as soon as his brother helps him in the writing, the story then takes a turn, because also the one thing that the scripting, the writing professor sold him
this one, you know, guy played by the great Brian Cox, who's apparently some successful screenwriter, does a screenwriting seminar that earlier in the film Charlie said was bullshit and a scam.
Yes, and it sounded like a cult.
Yeah.
But he gives in, and one of the pieces of advice is you can do whatever the fuck you want to do in the first, you know, three acts.
Yeah.
As long as you've got a good last act to wow them with, you can get away with anything.
Sadly true.
And, of course, he's giving you the blueprints of the entire thing without hiding it.
Oh.
And
I have a theory about Donald, the twin brother, but we'll get to that later.
So as soon as Donald starts working, helping him out, starts, you know, co-writing on it, of course, the story takes this dramatic, suspenseful turn with sex and drugs and, you know, intrigue and almost a chase scene kind of too, a few chase scenes even, and hilarity ensues.
Kaufman based adaptation on his struggles to adapt Susan Orlean's 1998 nonfiction book, The Orchid Thief, while suffering from writer's block. It involves elements adapted from the book, plus fictitious elements like the twin brother, who is also credited as a writer on the film, and the film is dedicated to Donald. Love that.
Yes.
And it culminates in completely invented elements.
You know, it was kind of shocking to find out that she was a real... She's a real writer. LaRouche is a real person. Yeah, still alive,
Kaufman,
too.
Kaufman said the idea of how to write the film didn't come to me until quite late. It was the only idea I had. I liked it. I knew there was no other way. There was no way it would be approved if I pitched it. So I just wrote it. Never told the people I was writing it for. I only told Spike Jones as we were making Being John Malkovich, and he saw how frustrated I was. Had he said I was crazy, I don't know what I would have done. He also said I really thought I was ending my career by turning it in. He told Jones while they were filming Malkovich, so I think maybe they shot some extra footage for adaptation during the making of Malkovich.
Wow, okay. That makes sense.
And just, you know, maybe some backgrounds and then, you know, green screen Cage into it, or maybe they already had the idea for Cage and they just had him, you know, brought him in. I don't know. Either way.
But it's perfect because he's just being completely ignored on the set. Nobody knows who the fuck he is even.
Yeah.
And of course it's just, he wasn't really there, but it could have been that they were just ignoring him anyway. That's how he felt.
And it starts with this whole monologue about how he's a hack.
Yes. And fat.
Every creative, especially those of us who are middle-aged, can totally relate to that.
Of course. My God.
I related to Charlie way too much in this film.
Oh, yeah.
Also, they cut to a bit of, like, the making of Malkovich, and it looks like Malkovich himself is directing.
Well, I think it was a long time ago we reviewed that.
Yeah.
But it was, like, he did take charge of that whole set, kind of.
Okay. You know? One of those actors who does that.
Well, because nobody had any experience. I mean, that was Kaufman's first film.
And Jones was a music video director.
I think it was Jones' first film, too, because I think he was just a music video guy before that.
But then we get into this montage about the history of Earth. Loved that.
Yes.
That has single-celled organisms develop into people and orchids and, you know, various animals.
And I love how they explain things later, like after the fact, like that whole thing. And he gets that idea of, like, you know, we'll try to tie the entire history of the world together. And then he realizes, oh, that's what that whole intro was.
Yeah. And Kaufman is an obsessive hypochondriac. Again, totally relate. loved his insistence on sticking to the book, you know, instead of going off on some weird angle or bringing in, you know, something dramatic.
Which, you know, he gives in the end.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just drop the theory now about Donald. I think Donald is the part of him that wants to give in to Hollywood.
Of course. Donald is kind of the adolescent, you know, guy he wishes he could be. Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's the whole adolescent dream. You know, he's with the ladies and, you know, everybody likes him. And, you know, just the whole thing is just so relatable, honestly.
And Donald has this ridiculous idea that ends up selling that is just total trash and total, you know.
There's a quote from the three at the end of the film, too, that I'm not even sure what the fuck it means.
Yeah. But, you know, he was basically playing against the part of himself he doesn't want to give into, but he knows he probably should for his career.
Yeah, well, and just to live a life more, you know? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of this and Malkovich, a lot of it is about feeling like an incomplete person, you know? Feeling like there are these pieces of you missing, and even feeling like a prisoner of, like, the Arcade Fire song that came after this, My Body is a Cage, you know, all of those feelings. If you just keep those in mind while watching these, you're like, ah! Mm-hmm.
There's that old, you know, philosophical question, would you rather be stupid and happy or awake and depressed? And he kind of splits both of those into two different people.
What's interesting, I think, fate, I guess, or happenstance, is that the movie we did last week, I think, is an interesting companion piece to this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, about that whole feeling about just things passing you by and just not getting out of yourself. Mm-hmm. I think the difference is Charlie Kaufman should have been the man who killed Hitler. That would have been an interesting movie instead of the, you know, everything bluster.
Anything written by Calvin would have been more interesting. Loved, you know, when Donald is pitching this ridiculous serial killer multiple personality idea, Kaufman just gives up. Charlie just is like, okay, I give up. It's a good idea. Run with it.
Well, yeah, he decides to be nice and, like, you know, okay, whatever. And really, you know, the whole thing is, who knows what works in Hollywood? What gets somebody's attention? It is a lot of it just seems like chance.
Mm. Well, a lot of it is chance. A lot of anything is chance or who you know. It's being surprisingly
the right
place who you know.
The right time, and of course, who you know. And he happens to know Charlie Kaufman.
And, you know, a lot of it is if it's reminiscent of something that was successful, you know, they don't like to take chances.
Yeah.
Seeing him flirt with the waitress, though, that was so... I have a very low tolerance for... I get sympathetically anxious a lot. Embarrassed a lot. I have a low tolerance for sympathetic embarrassment. Seeing him flirt with this waitress who was only being nice to him because it's her job...
Yeah.
...was... That hurt.
Yeah, and you know... Yeah, it happens so often. But... I guess the difference is awareness. I mean, mm-hmm. he was aware that he crossed the line. He thought, why not me? You know, why not try this? Uh-huh. Yeah. It was after coming back, of course, the first time.
And it was after, not long after he'd had a fantasy about her.
Yeah.
That his brother interrupted to pitch the serial killer idea. Also, I had no idea, and this is actually not true, I've looked it up, but Fellini did not invent the mockumentary, as Donald said, but he was one of the early contributors to the genre.
Wait.
It goes back a lot longer than you think.
I just assumed that was a joke because, I mean, Fellini mostly silent?
Fellini did make a mockumentary.
Okay.
But it goes back a little, like 1800 something, but it... Fellini was definitely in there. The prosthetic teeth on Chris Cooper, who plays LaRoche, the organ tuner.
Yeah, I hardly even recognized him.
Disturbingly real, those teeth.
Yeah. I was wondering if he did a Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm. But in that...
When I say that, the famous story in Dumb and Dumber was they were all like, is he going to be such a pretty boy and he's tough to work with? And then he comes in, he, like, fucking chips his teeth, as soon as they start the shoot.
Right. But when he's backing out, you don't even know it's a flashback in that one scene until he turns and you see his teeth.
Yeah.
Right before the thing happens.
That was all brutal. But this whole story. Yeah.
But I love how they reveal, because they just cut to that flashback very quickly with no warning. And you don't know what's going on until you see him turn toward the camera and you see his teeth and, oh shit, this is how they got fucked up.
Yeah, his mom's in the car with him and you know, things are, you know, talking about how things are going well and all that. And it's after the dinner party scene in New York with, you know, people kind of making fun of him and stuff for his appearance and, you know, just not being from a coastal, you know, elite kind of thing.
Right. I did appreciate Kaufman's Charlie. I tend to refer to people with last names, but I'll use first names just to distinguish Charlie's line about wanting to grow and not just rely on, you know, these crazy gimmicks. And I think also Donald was a way of kind of convincing himself to get back to fundamentals.
True.
You know, Donald was talking about these, you know, screenwriting tips that he got from the seminar, and Charlie was kind of, you know, ignoring him, but he eventually did kind of look into that stuff.
And the whole Casablanca is the greatest screenplay ever made, made me laugh out loud.
I've actually never seen Casablanca, but I have a similar feeling about Citizen Kane.
I've never sat through the entire film, but I have read the script. I had to do it in some of my theater classes, and it's horrendous. It's just these cliches thrown at each other, strung together into a script. The only great reason why people love it is nostalgia.
Citizen Kane, I watched it some years ago.
Now, Citizen Kane, I get the love for that because the filmmaking technique.
Sure. Visually, I get that he was, you know, breaking some ground visually.
He went to places people had not taken film before.
But acting-wise, story-wise, it was just kind of eh.
For that time, it was good.
But no, there are better acted, better written films of that time. Really? But it was a situation, I think, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to make this comparison. I think it was like the original Star Wars, where the story is kind of eh, but everybody was so blown away by the visuals.
Just wait till we get to the TV show.
You know.
And that pilot.
Yeah.
Linger longer.
Everyone was so blown away by the visuals in Star Wars, they kind of overestimated. I think they remember it being a better film than it is. And I love New Hope, but...
I think back then people just had more patience.
Maybe. Anyway, back to adaptation.
Yes.
I also have to say I related to his delusional crush on the author.
Oh. Oh, man. That whole string is terrible, too. Where he flies to New York to meet with her, gets to the building, and then, you know, passes the floor, and then she gets in the elevator. He still doesn't say anything.
Right. It was another sympathetic embarrassment moment. Also, Donald, I think, also maybe represents his kind of sense of play in his beginner mind, which he wants to get back to.
I don't know. Donald doesn't seem like he gets much.
But, I mean, his sense of, like, there are no rules in screenwriting and, you know, just being a beginner screenwriter without having to bog himself down with, is it good enough?
Just getting the job done.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of what Donald represents. The line, I have no understanding of anything outside of my own panic and self-loathing. Oh, big fucking mood. That line knocked me out of my chair almost. But I loved seeing Kaufman write the movie we were watching.
Oh, yeah. It was kind of a treat to see it, honestly. Like, who gets to sit next to a writer while he's working on something? It's never been done before, I don't think.
And he's also kind of starstruck by Catherine Keener being at his house, but she was in Malkovich. Had a pretty big role in Malkovich. I'm sure they had met.
Well, I mean, maybe they were alluding that he just kind of sat there and nobody knew who he was or anything.
That's true. I mean, the writer's not always on set, but, you know, obviously he was, you know, if he'd had this discussion with Spike Jonze, But
he would do like half waves to some people in the cast every now and again, and everybody just ignored him. Nobody knew who he was.
I kind of feel like Donald is the exaggeration of his confident side.
Yeah.
Charlie is the exaggeration of his shy, neurotic side.
You hope.
You know, I don't think he really is Charlie. I think he kind of split those two sides of himself and turned them up to 11.
Interesting trivia about Kaufman. Since I had to look up his... was this really his first movie? And yes, it is. He was a TV writer, and guess what his first TV show was that he ever wrote for?
What?
Get a Life with Chris Elliott.
Oh, God.
He wrote two episodes.
Explains a lot. And so Malkovich was his first film. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Gotta say, the photoshopping on the supposed topless photo of Olean, Meryl Streep's character.
Yes.
Laughably bad.
Yes.
And, I mean, I've been playing with Photoshop for 20 years. I'm pretty good at citing a fake. But this wasn't supposed to be a fake.
Yeah, it's true. It wasn't.
In the context of the film, it was an actual topless photo of her. Obviously, it was Photoshopped.
I had imagined that was a fake at first, too, even after the fact that they introduced the relationship between the two of them.
I just assumed it was because earlier he'd talked about, you know, when his orchids were all killed, he got into porn. he got in making porn, you know, producing it. And so here, you know, he got her into it. I assumed in the context of the film it was a real photo of her, but it was horribly photoshopped. Maybe it was supposed to be a bad Photoshop.
And I also just assumed that this wasn't a real person when the story revealed themselves, because like, who would be crazy enough to agree to this? But they talked her into it.
When he says you're shinier than an ant, and she says, that's the sweetest thing anyone has ever said to me. You had to figure out that they were fucking high.
Of course.
And I think they had revealed before then that the Seminoles that he was working with were, using the orchids for drugs.
The shinier than the ant thing was after the dial tone scene, which...
Well, yeah, the dial tone scene was kind of an indication, I guess.
Because she's just, like, listening to the dial tone. They'd be interested with it. And then having them recreate the dial tone.
I don't know. I feel like that's something... That's not that... tripped out, the dial tone thing. To me. Maybe I'm just enough of an audio geek that I would actually think to try that, but that last act really takes a turn.
Well, of course, that's when Donald starts writing the
story. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, it's pretty obvious, but it's not like they say, okay, and now Donald's writing this part.
Right, no.
It's like, oh, I'll help you out, and then all of a sudden... Yeah. Stories of intrigue and sex and drugs.
And that explains, I was wondering about something. Why didn't they just get back in the car? Because, they get out of the car, she's got him at gunpoint. Olean has Charlie at gunpoint. And Donald sneaks up behind her, knocks her down. They could have just gotten back in the fucking car. They'd established that the keys were still in the ignition. But instead, they ran through the swamp.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
When they opened the door, you heard the bell. The keys were still in the ignition. But they ended up running through the swamp. Donald would have written it that way. Loved the line, you are what you love, not what loves you.
Yeah, that's deep, man.
Reminds me of a line from an anime called The Devil is a Part-Timer. Along similar lines. Loved that. I was on Facebook checking my messages, because I was running late tonight, and I, looking at the reply from you, when, Olean yelled, John, kind of freaked me out for a second. I gotta wonder how metaphorical killing Donald is.
Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Is he killing that side of himself that wants to sell out?
It's tough to say.
I'm probably horribly overthinking all of this, but...
Well, how could you not? I mean...
I mean, it's a Charlie Kaufman film. They're meant right. to overthink, but...
Like, this is something you could watch I don't know how many times and pick up, like, new things.
Yeah, he's blocked on this idea. He kind of wants to do something that isn't his usual crazy shit. And, you know, he's banging his head against the wall. Suddenly his brother, who clearly represents the part of him that just wants to give in to Hollywood and be an adolescent and be happy and kind of sell yeah. out. You know, he gives into that side and things get interesting, but then that side gets killed. And I wonder if, you know, that was a choice to like say, okay, no, I'm not selling out.
There's also a theme throughout this about using tragedy to free yourself. You know, like LaRouche's ex left him because of that tragedy.
Right.
Orlean, you know, mm-hmm. used the drugs to free herself.
Right, right.
And then, of course, with Donald, I mean, because maybe he doesn't exist means that option doesn't really exist. If you're just less okay. right about a focus.
So he just, I don't know. He killed it anyway because it was pointless to even explore it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you could be right.
I gotta say, I knew Kaufman couldn't die in the movie he wrote that was about him writing the film.
All bets are off.
I kind of wish he had, just because I love how it would have broken reality.
He turned a writer from The New Yorker into like a, yeah. you know, snorting, drug-snorting, gun-toting
yeah.
maniac.
He had to have gotten permission.
A writer from The Reporter. Oh, of course. He had it first, though. He had it written first, and they put it in her, and she was like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Because this is ostensibly the adaptation of the book.
Yeah.
That's not another film that came out at a different time. This is the adaptation of the book.
Like, she originally said no. They had to, like, badger her.
Okay.
Like, it hurts if Spike Jones.
And I'm sure they cleared it with LaRouche as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Speaking of LaRouche, the gator killing him was telegraphed as hell, but I still got a kick out of it.
there had to be a Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah. Because Cox's character.
After Cox made this proclamation. Yeah.
Never fucking use a Deus Ex Machina.
And never. Like, he's totally going to use a Deus Ex Machina.
It's the exact one I have the quote. Don't you dare throw in a Deus Ex Machina. And he was kind of a Deus Ex Machina. The gator was definitely a Deus Ex Machina.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Also loved Streep's lines about wanting to be new. And basically just wanted to start over again with her life. That wrecked me. As did when Kaufman called his mother to tell her about Donald.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he didn't even get to the... We didn't see him telling her about Donald. Just that the beginning of the call got me.
Well, right. And that's all you really needed, too. Yeah. Was that just that beginning, because you just... Like, how many times is that phone call made?
Mm-hmm. And you know, Streep's lines, like, last year was real rough on me. So, you know, I loved Streep's lines about having just wanting a do-over. Loved Kaufman second-guessing his voiceover at the end.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm using a voiceover. Ah, you know, screw it. This is the best way to convey this.
Yeah. And of course, at the very end of the credits, dedicated to Donald Kaufman.
In loving memory.
Yeah. Obviously, no room for sequels or remakes.
No.
You never want to remake a Kaufman film, a Kaufman Jones
no.
film. And no point to a sequel. On to Brains.
On to Brains.
It's a 5. It's a Kaufman film. It's a Kaufman Jones film. How do you not give it a 5?
I'm trying to remember if we gave
Anomalisa a 5. Anomalisa, one of those was like a 4 or 4.5, I think.
But I think the other couple that we've done have
Malkovich
been 5s.
Malkovich was a double 5, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And Synecdoche, I think, was a double five.
I think so, too. That was pretty damn crazy. Yeah. And that was Philip Seymour Hoffman, too. Mm, so yeah. It was nuts. And, yeah, this is such an easy five. Yeah. Such a goddamn amazing story about life and fear and passion and paralysis and just...
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange... It almost is kind of a feel-good, cathartic kind of thing, really.
This is... I love this for the same reason I love Fooly Cooly. For those who haven't been with us long, since, you know, the last time I brought Fooly Cooly, it's an anime that it's my favorite thing in the world. I watch it on my birthday every year. On the surface, it's this absurdist science fiction story. Under the surface, it's this very relatable coming-of-age story. This, on the surface, is this ridiculous reality-bending story about writing a screenplay. But under the surface...
If you know anything about writing and the experience of writing, though,
yeah,
this is it, man. Like, you are arguing with the blank page. You're mm-hmm. arguing with yourself. You're
arguing about if you're successful and you have a tendency to be an artiste, like Kaufman, you're arguing with that side of you that wants to sell out.
You fluctuate between, you know, being a megalomaniac and mm-hmm. being and having imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
It's fucking nuts. It's probably why I haven't done it in so long.
And I do it every fucking week. I post two poems every week. And so, you know, if you're a creative, this movie speaks to your soul, especially if you are older, if you're, you know, getting into middle age.
It's not even a stretch. It's like, oh yeah, totally. Oh yeah, I've done that.
Yeah. And that's it for adaptation. Until next week, when we'll be reviewing Willy's Wonderland.
What have we learned?
Oh, what have we learned? I am sorry. I skipped over that. I have a great gag for that, too.
Yeah.
What have we learned?
Well, I learned I could be disappointed if there isn't a Deus Ex Machina in a film. It's a first. I don't think I've ever had that. I've been like, come on, there's got to be one here somewhere.
And I learned that I should get coffee as I take a sip of coffee. And finally, that's it for adaptation. Until next week, when we'll be reviewing Willy's Wonderland. That title, kind of disturbing. But it kind of looks like a movie adaptation of Five Nights at Freddy's, if you know what that is. It's basically you're trapped in a Chuck E. Cheese when the animatronics come alive and try to kill you.
Oh, right, right.
And that's what this movie looks like. Should be interesting. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.